Welcome. I'm Sarah White, a retired director of pharmacy. I hope this conversation stimulates you to think about how to continue to evolve our pharmacy services on behalf of our patients. Remember, every pharmacist needs to be a little L leader on their shift or in their practice. While each person's career evolves in a different way, what you'll find as a baseline is them making and seizing opportunities. By way of a brief introduction, Bill Ellis received his undergraduate pharmacy degree from the Philadelphia College of Pharmacy and Sciences, a Master's of Science in Health Education from St. Joseph's University, and completed the executive residency at ASHP. He has held several leadership positions, beginning with being the Executive Vice President for the Pennsylvania Society of Health System Pharmacists, Executive Director, Center for Proper Medication Use, Director, Quality Center, American Pharmacists Association, CEO and Executive Director, APHA's Foundation, and is currently the Executive Director, BPS, the Board of Pharmacy Specialties. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Let's begin with BPS. Why don't you trace its development and evolution?
Well, the beginning of BPS, or the Board of Pharmacy Specialties, and actually specialties in pharmacy, goes back to some work even in the mid-60s. Paul Parker was beginning to write about the evolution of hospital practice and began to identify that pharmacists were working in specialized areas. So in 1971, the American Pharmacist Association House of Delegates passed a resolution that called for APHA to study specialization in the profession of pharmacy. And so a task force was put together, the APHA Task Force on Specialization in Pharmacy, in 1973. And that group deliberated for about a year, published their report in 1974, and they concluded that the profession of pharmacy should have a body, an independent body, to be able to deal with the issue of specialization, set standards, award those credentials. The group didn't go as far as to say what those specialties should be, but that the profession should have a way to board certified pharmacists in specialty areas. It was also, while that was going on in the early 70s, there was also this groundswell in consideration of specialties. Don Franke had been writing about this, and the Millis Commission report by the American Association of Colleges of Pharmacies also began to identify that there was differentiation in pharmacy practice. So a lot of things really coalesced together at that point that led to the formation of the Board of Pharmacy Specialties in 1976. You know, one of the things it's important, Sarah, to talk about here, because it's held true even today, is that when that task force set about its work, it gathered input from across the professions, various organizations, and it also sought input from outside of pharmacy, medicine and nursing. And to this day, BPS really believes in that philosophical approach to our work, and we try very much to work across the major professional organizations and specialty societies in pharmacy, and routinely draw input from medicine and nursing. So we actually have two positions on our board of directors. One is designated for a nursing representative, and the other is designated for a representative from medicine. So those very principles back in the 70s still hold true today, and I think have served us well.
So what were the first specialties?
So the very first specialty to be recognized was nuclear pharmacy. So that was recognized in 1978. And it made sense at the time. There was a section, APHA had just completed the work of this task force. There was a nuclear pharmacist section within APHA that coalesced around 1975. And there was general consensus across pharmacy that nuclear pharmacy was a unique and specialized area. It required specialized training and skills in dealing with those products and issues related to safety. So that was sort of a natural for BPS to do that and recognize that first specialty in 1978. there was about 10 years before the next specialties were recognized. The next two specialties, both recognized in 1988, nutrition support pharmacy, which was created through a petition from the American Society of Health System Pharmacists and Hospital Pharmacists, and ASPEN, the American Society of Parenteral and Enteral Nutrition. Also in 1988, BPS recognized pharmacotherapy based on a petition from the American College of Clinical Pharmacy. So 10-year gap and then two specialties. And pharmacotherapy today has gone on to become the largest specialty within the BPS structure, with almost 75% of the board-certified pharmacists holding the pharmacotherapy certification.
So once there is a petition, then what all happens around that?
So BPSs believe that, and again, true to our roots, that specialties need to be recognized from the ground up. And so the BPS board, though we have the final decision on whether a specialty is recognized or not, responds to petitions from the profession to recognize a specialty area. So we don't separate out and make that decision on our own. It has to come up organically from the profession. And there were seven criteria that were identified as part of that original task force in 1974 that have pretty much held true 40 years later today. I mean, it's amazing to me when I go back and I read that task force, the tremendous amount of insight and vision that those individuals had in doing that. Some folks are on that task force. Lloyd Parks was the chair. John Gans was part of that task force, Warren Weaver. So that group did tremendous work. And those criteria still have held up today. And so there's roughly seven criteria, and they relate to need for the proposed specialty area, demand, and then each specialty has to have a unique body of knowledge that represents the specialty. They have to have unique activities. What kinds of things are those specialists doing that are different than general practice? And then we look at some other criteria. How are specialists trained? So how does the specialty ultimately propagate itself and continue to grow? And are there standards? And is there consistency among that training? Then we look at things like transmission of knowledge. So can we go to the literature and see that there are routine publications and lectures and scholarly work and research around the particular specialty area? So they're the criteria that we generally look at. And so an organization that petitions BPS has to address each of those criteria and make the case that this proposed specialty area meets all of those areas. So that involves quite a bit of work. Usually some kind of analysis, maybe meta-analysis of the literature. Probably also involves some initial or new research, usually survey work. And the other thing that it involves, which is key to specialties, is conducting what's called a role delineation study or a job task analysis. And this is where a group of subject matter experts in the proposed specialty area get together and debate and discuss sort of what would that specialist job description look like, a complete job description, and what is in their purview and what's not in their purview. And that is really a critical step in a valid specialty certification examination. And so that process is conducted, subject matter experts design the content outline, and then it's validated by surveying pharmacists to practice in the proposed specialty area to see, yes, this is what I do, or no, this is what I don't do. And so the final result of that really results in a content outline for the specialty area. And so it's based on all of that information that BPS makes its decision. And we've consistently always held open hearings for any new specialty, so we get input from the profession itself. We do seek input from those outside of the profession, colleagues in medicine, nursing, employers, hospital administrators, educators, to try to validate the specialty. So it's a pretty extensive process. The average petition probably is somewhere in the range of 450 to 600 pages when it's all said and done. So it's a very complete, exhaustive process.
So once it's approved, what happens then?
So the process takes, well, the role delineation study takes about a year to conduct the role delineation or job analysis. BPS typically in our old bylaws allowed up to a year to analyze and make a decision on those. And in 2012, our board shrunk that timeline to 6 months so that we have a quicker turnaround on those things. And then once the specialty is approved, then BPS, and this was in the original 1974 task force report, appoints a specialty council of 9 members that essentially governs that specialty. So then there's the process for the call for members to serve as that initial specialty council. We have 9 members on our specialty council, and 6 of whom, once a specialty is mature and we've been given the exam, has 6 members who are board certified in that specialty. And then there are 3 other pharmacists on that 9-member council who are not board certified. Obviously, in a new specialty, no one is board certified, but they are subject matter experts in that area. And that's, you know, as we sit here in 2013, that's exactly where we are today as it relates to pediatrics and critical care, which are the 2 most recent specialties approved by BPS. So once that task force is convened, they have to decide on what the eligibility criteria are going to be for the examination. They have to decide what the recertification criteria are going to be. And then they have a huge job in terms of putting together the item bank to begin to test individuals and think about awarding certification in the specialty area.
And the testing is done with outside resources as well, correct?
Yeah, it's a collaboration. So BPS is responsible for building the item bank of valid test questions. And the item bank of test questions is mapped to the content outline. So based on that role delineation study, there's usually 3 to 5 domains per specialty. And we tell candidates, and it's publicly available on our website, that X percent of this exam is going to come from domain 1, X percent from domain 2. So it's mapped. And the development of exam questions needs to mirror that. But we do contract with outside help and support to administer the exam. We use psychometric consultants, so that helps make sure the exam is valid and legally defensible. So these are individuals, PhD trained, that study the construct of examinations, proper questions, making sure they're fair, they're not biased, that they really also discern the knowledge level of the individual. So it's a very rigorous process, and so we do contract for outside help. And then the other piece is the actual administration of the exam at testing centers, and so there's an infrastructure of testing centers out there. We contract to make sure that those exam sites are available and accessible to candidates who want to test.
How has the growth in accountability in healthcare influenced accreditation and certification in your view?
Oh, I think that's been a big, big driver in healthcare. Folks are looking for purchasers, be they consumer purchasers or the government or other employers, are looking for accountability in the delivery of healthcare. And they're looking for some level of assurance that the services that they are purchasing are of sufficient quality. So that's been a general backdrop, I believe, in healthcare. We are really in the era of accountability. I don't think that's going to change. I only think that's going to continue to be ratcheted up. And so the timing of that, I think, worked out very well for BPS. So there's been this natural growth in board certification, and we've seen a lot of trends, particularly on the employer side, related to requiring board certification. And that's also been underpinned not only by employers, which is very important, but we've seen that reflected in the policy of many major national pharmacy organizations who have gone on record saying that pharmacists that are practicing at advanced levels and dealing with complex drug therapy issues should consider or should be board certified. So a lot of this is kind of coalesced at the same time, probably starting, I guess, in the, you know, the mid-90s. Continuing through today, and we don't really see that changing at all.
So talk a little bit about the recertification process, because you need to maintain, if I understand it correctly, your board certification.
Well, that's right. So the certification is not a one-time certification. You know, the other thing, too, I want to back up a little bit, because this is important for folks to understand about our board certification process. Everyone focuses on the examination, and that is critical, and they're the things that people really do think about. But our process to become board certified initially is a multi-step process. So first, you have to make sure you've graduated from an accredited college of pharmacy. You have to have a valid license to practice. But beyond that, and this is the piece that sometimes gets lost, you have to have a certain number of years experience in the specialty area where you're practicing at least 50% of your time or more in the specialty area to be eligible to sit for the exam. And that's important because when we talk to the public and employers, you want to make sure that folks have the knowledge base. And the exam does a good job of testing your knowledge base, but you've got to have the practical experience to apply that knowledge.
Yes.
And that's part of the assurance that BPS certification gives the public and gives employers and other stakeholders in the healthcare system, that the board certified pharmacist has both the knowledge and the experience to do that. And so part of that experience can be tied to residency training. And that's the other thing that sort of coalesced. The fastest path to board certification eligibility, sit for the exam, is completion of either a PGY1 or PGY2. And that varies a little bit based on specialty, but that generally is your fastest path, because those residency programs are structured and they're learning experiences, and they're also accredited by the American Society of Health System Pharmacists. In fact, we only accept residencies that are accredited by ASHP for purposes of eligibility. Now, BPS also realizes that not every individual has the opportunity to participate in a residency. So in that case, there's an alternate path with 3 to 4 years of actual practice experience that you can meet that practice eligibility criteria. So that's the process that gets you there. So once you've gone through that and you've passed the examination, now it's important to hold out to the public and employers again that you are maintaining your knowledge base and the expertise that you've demonstrated up to this point. And so there's two paths there that individuals can use to maintain their certification. The first path is that it's a 7-year recertification cycle, and an individual can sit for a recertification exam at the end of 7 years. And some individuals do that. It's not the majority of folks, probably 15 or 20%, but some individuals do choose that. The other path is to embark upon a series of continuing education activities that are based on the content outlined for the exam and are offered by organizations that BPS approves to be a provider. So all of this coursework is ACP approved, but to count for your recertification of BPS, it has to be through one of the approved providers that are out there, and we designate one or two providers in each specialty where pharmacists can get that. Now, some folks say, well, you know, with continuing education, shouldn't everybody just recertify by exam? But again, I think what some people forget about the recertification by CE is that individuals must pass a post-test for every continuing education module, which is rigorous. And so they're actually testing multiple times during their 7-year cycle if they choose the continuing education route, because it's at a higher level than the general requirements for pharmacist continuing education. And so that gets you through that process of maintaining your certification over a 7-year cycle.
When you joined BPS in 2010, what were your immediate challenges?
Oh, that's an interesting question. You know, I think what we had in 2010 was opportunities more than we really had challenges. At that point in time, this era of accountability was clearly upon us. We had a lot of pent-up demand for additional certifications. We had already seen employers begin to build very formally into their career ladder structure BPS certification, VA probably being primary on that list, where pharmacists that are board certified within the VA system are eligible for pay grade increases and also become eligible for various clinical positions. And we've seen that in other areas of the federal government, public health service and some other areas. Some other private sector employers like Kaiser Permanente in Denver have long been a leader. So all of these things were kind of going on at the same time. And so really our challenge was to begin to ramp up. We had approved ambulatory care in 2009, but it had been about a decade before we had approved any other new specialties before ambulatory care. So how do we get there quickly, meet this demand, still make sure we're maintaining a high quality certification program? One of the strategic decisions our board made at the time was to take responsibility for conducting those role delineation studies or job task analysis. That previously had been part of the petition process, and it still is, but it was required by the petitioning organization. BPS said, why don't we do this ourselves? We can begin to jumpstart the process to explore new specialties and help spread the cost to do that. And at the end, you could look at that role delineation study and probably have a pretty good idea whether a proposed specialty had a good chance of being recognized or not. So we took that on and completed role delineation studies in pain and palliative care, pediatrics, critical care, cardiology, and infectious diseases within a 2-year period. So it was a very aggressive timetable, and recently approved pediatrics and critical care. And the other three are in various stages of consideration. So that was really the goal, to kind of jumpstart that process, still work across the profession to do these things, which has been our hallmark. And then there were some other things that we had to do really related to infrastructure. Up to that point in time, up through 2012, the BPS exam was a paper and pencil exam, and it was administered one day a year, traditionally the first Saturday in October. The demand and the requirements and even finding physical facilities to administer exams in quiet areas when, for example, in Baltimore, I think we had 350 people test on one Saturday. And so there was all kinds of challenges related to that. So we embarked on a process to figure out who the right partners were going to be and contracted with a new test administrator, psychometric consultant, which leads to the 2013 exam administration, which is now a computer-based examination. Still the same 4-part multiple choice questions that the exam had been, but now administered through a computer-based platform. And then administered over a window of 3 weeks in October. So it created more flexibility for candidates, a broader range of opportunity. In 2012, we had, I believe we had about 85 sites where we tested globally. In 2013, we're going to be at 650 sites. So this was a dramatic increase for BPS. And I'm excited about the computer-based platform for a couple of reasons, too. There's a consistency that's there, but it also, in the future, will allow us to test at some higher cognitive levels. We'll be able to use patient videos, we'll be able to use graphics, you know, all kinds of different testing that will allow new ways to assess a practitioner's knowledge in the proposed specialty area. So that was an important infrastructure issue that we had to begin to deal with. So they were some of the things early on that we had to tackle. And again, it was really more about managing the opportunities and doing all this in a way that was reasonable and scalable so that this process would hold up over time. And, you know, I guess we felt a little bit of pressure, because if you look back to what the founders did in 1974, they designed a process that has lasted 40 years. So we wanted to make sure that this process, any changes that we would make, certainly would hold up over time or be flexible enough to account for some changes that could take place in the healthcare delivery system or in the training of pharmacists, all of those kinds of things.
So you've referred a couple of times to your board of directors, and they're sort of your boss. Correct?
Mm-hmm.
Who else sits on the board? You mentioned a nurse, a physician.
So the BPS board is comprised of 5 specialists. So we have 8 specialties now. 5 specialties are represented on the board, and they represent board certified pharmacists. So they're not really representing the specific specialty, but they are representing the general population of board certified pharmacists. Then we have 3 pharmacists who sit on our board who are non-specialists. So they bring a different perspective and come from different backgrounds. Many times they're administrators or employers, but they are pharmacists. And then we have a public member, and that's a requirement for our accreditation, that there be a member of the public. Our current public member is a sociologist, and really brings a different perspective and enriches our board discussion. And then we have the two representatives, one from medicine and one from nursing. So that comprises the board. And then I serve as a non-voting member of the board, and then the American Pharmacist Association, as a founding member, has a non-voting observer who sits in. So that's our board composition.
You referred to the organization that oversights BPS. Talk a little bit about that.
So many organizations, have accreditation, and see it in hospitals with Joint Commission. In the world of certification, where we live, there's the National Commission on Certifying Agencies, NCCA. Mm-hmm. And this is important to BPS, that our program be accredited, because by being accredited, we agree to and prove that we follow best practices and standards in certification. And that accreditation is an example to the public and to other stakeholders, and even to our certificates, that we are following best practices in testing and awarding and maintaining credentials. So that's very important to us. Each of our specialties has to be individually accredited. So there's not a blanket accreditation to BPS. We have to apply for each specialty. So five specialties are accredited. Ambulatory care, being the first exam, was in 2011. We're in 2013, is just eligible this year, and we just completed submission of our accreditation application for ambulatory care. But our goal clearly is to make sure that all of our programs are accredited through NCCA. And in the future, we'll probably start to look at other accreditations too, including ISO, because one of the very interesting things that's happening with board certification is our certification already is and continues to grow to be a global credential. We test in 26 countries on a regular basis, and probably somewhere between 10 and 15% of our applicant pool each year come from outside of the United States. So this is truly a global credential, and we want to make sure we're also representing to the global community that we're meeting appropriate standards for certification of pharmacists.
And the Council on Credentialing in Pharmacy, who's that and what role do they play?
So this is a group that formed some years ago. It's a U.S.-based group, and it represents a number of pharmacist organizations, and the membership changes a little bit over time. But the goal is to have a body that can sit back and look at the credentialing of pharmacists from the time a student enrolls and enters a college of pharmacy to when they graduate to the licensure, then to other credentials that they may earn, including certificates for certificate training programs, residencies, all of the other kinds of training that go into that end, and certainly at the one end and at the high end, board certification. But it seems to make sense through CCP to have a forum to talk about all of those broad issues around credentialing, making sure that there's alignment amongst all of those parts and that everyone knows what other groups are doing and that there's a reasoned approach, because it just makes sense for the profession. I mean, we're a relatively small profession when you compare to medicine and nursing, and there needs to be efficiency in this process. So this group, doesn't have any real policy-making authority, but we publish a series of white papers that create frameworks for individuals to think about the overall credentialing of pharmacists. So it's been very lively, very good discussions around that table, and one that I think benefits the profession because it does add some clarity and it does harmonize to some extent through those discussions the work that's being done as pharmacists work their way through. One of the areas we're working on now that's I know going to be a big deal, particularly in hospitals, is credentialing and privileging. So, we've seen privileging in medicine for sure, and to some extent in nursing. Pharmacy really, in some ways, is just sticking our toe in that pond. And there'll be a white paper coming out probably early 2014 that starts to talk about how the profession could think about credentialing and privileging a pharmacist, defining what those terms are. So it's a good resource for individual pharmacists, for pharmacy administrators, for employers to think about that. But I truly believe that in the not too distant future, we'll see pharmacists fully involved in a credentialing and privileging process similar to what we see in medicine as their patient care roles expand.
At this point in time, approximately how many board-certified pharmacists do we have?
So there are 16,000 board-certified pharmacists. And, you know, the interesting thing, Sarah, about that is this number has been doubling every 5 years from about the mid-90s. Things got off to a little bit of a slow start in the 70s and then picked up some momentum in the 80s, then really picked up momentum. So from probably 97 on, the number of board-certified pharmacists has doubled every 5 years. So we're at 16,000 now. BPS has set a goal that by 2017, we'll have 30,000 board-certified pharmacists. So there's been quite an uptick in that. And I think that a number will grow. It could well expand beyond that. I'm not really sure where the ceiling is going to be. We're adding new specialties. Again, the era of accountability, there'll be a need for these credentials. I'm not quite sure where that will shake out. There's been some debate in the profession. You know, are there too many specialists? You know, I don't know. I think the marketplace is going to decide that. When we look at our colleagues in medicine, it's become a requirement for reimbursement and for other things. And so I think probably somewhere in the range of 90% of all physicians are board certified. So I don't know whether that's going to make sense for pharmacy. We don't have that crystal ball. But we'll build a process that'll scale. And then obviously the marketplace and other factors will determine whether that's 20% of the profession or 90% of the profession. But if we build a model that can accommodate that, I think we'll be in a good place.
In January of 2013, BPS issued a white paper outlining a 5-year vision. Why don't you talk a little bit about what was in that white paper?
Well, you know, this was an important paper for us to publish because we felt we had to convey to the public at large, to our stakeholders in pharmacy, to our stakeholders in medicine, where we were headed. And we are moving very rapidly. So we needed to answer some questions, put some context around that, set some goals. So the goal of 30,000 board-certified pharmacists by 2017 was articulated in that white paper, driven largely by the extent that we know we need at least that many or potentially more to meet the needs of patients. So that was a pretty straightforward goal. But one of the statements that we made that was important, a couple areas. We tied future, because I get this question all the time, say, well, what's the next specialty? And I tell folks, I think if you look at the evolution of PGY2 residencies, the specialty residencies, that will give you some insight as to where the next specialties could come from. And so we just made the statement that we think future specialties should be tied to the availability of PGY2 residencies that are accredited by ASHP. You know, we have a caveat that there may be exceptions to that, but generally that's the direction that we should move. And again, it speaks to that alignment that we think we need in the profession to have a reasonable approach. The other commentary we made, which is really important in this white paper, is we broached the idea of subspecialties. Again, this was talked about in 1974 as a possibility. I think it's taken a while to obviously build the infrastructure. And my predecessors, Sam Kalman and Dick Burton, did an amazing job in building a strong infrastructure that's allowed us to continue to grow. And so we now think it's time to visit the idea of should we create a subspecialty process. And we put out in the white paper that we believe the model could draw parallels to the American Board of Medical Specialties. ABMS has 24 member boards, so it's 24 specialties, and they have about 140 subspecialties. Now, we're not proposing 140 subspecialties. It might not even be 24 specialties. But we think the concept of a primary board certification is important because the pharmacist knowledge, and this is where we think the pharmacist value equation differs than the medical specialist, the pharmacist has a broad and deep knowledge of therapeutics. And we think that's extremely valuable. And we don't want to lose that by becoming so specialized. And anecdotally, I have pharmacists that are board certified say they draw on their general medication knowledge to resolve issues that are not directly in their specialty area but impact the patient, that have to be resolved, and the medical specialists come to them. So, you know, for example, and I think we use this example in the white paper, the board-certified psychiatric pharmacist treating a patient with acute depression because of a chronic disease like diabetes, a lot of times you've got to get that chronic disease under control like diabetes before you can get to the other issues. And so we think that that value proposition of pharmacist knowledge and skill being broad-based is important, and we want to maintain that in our board certification structure. So we propose a series of primary specialties. The profession will enter into a dialogue and decide what that looks like and decide if this parallel with ABMS makes sense. We think it does, but we'll vet that both with pharmacy and even medicine and nursing to see what their thoughts are. And then the idea would be that if someone earns a primary certification in a specialty area. And we think that the specialties we have right now are pretty well set up to do that. When you look at broad specialty areas like oncology and pediatrics and ambulatory care and pharmacotherapy, it could lead very easily to a model where then you could have some subspecialization underneath that. So that was important that we put that out on the table. And you know, I don't know, we'll try to decide that over the next, you know, 2 to 4 or 5 years. So that we know going forward where all these things fit and what should be a specialty or what might be considered a subspecialty. So we've got to develop those criteria. So that was important. The other, a couple other points we made in the white paper is we did comment on international pharmacists seeking certification, and committed to a task force to start to look at those international issues. It's pretty apparent, I think, to many of us on the BPS board that the world is a lot smaller place. And we're a regular participant in the FIP meetings, and we're seeing that, and we're seeing a lot more global dialogue about pharmacist education and training. And so we want to make sure, and interest in board certification, as we see by the numbers. So we want to make sure that we're sensitive to those needs and that we work through those issues. So that was a point that we made. The other big thing, and we had touched on this earlier, is this whole idea of recertification. The recertification process has to really, well, first and foremost, it has to assure the public that people are maintaining the competency level that they were originally certified in, but it also has to be meaningful to the board certified pharmacist. And so right now, the recertification activities are largely continuing education based. We're in a self-study process now as a result of this white paper to say, are there other activities that could count for recertification that would be valid and yet meaningful to the individual? So credit related to research, scholarly publications, you know, mentoring and teaching, not exclusively any one of those things, but just a broader palette to choose from to demonstrate that you've maintained your competence. And we just think that's important because at the end, this still is largely a voluntary credential. And the process has to be meaningful to those folks. So we recognize that and made that statement in the white paper. So they're probably some of the, you know, the high water marks in that paper that we'll be working on over the next 5 years. And if we can resolve those things and have some conclusions on those, I think we'll be well positioned for the future.
And I'm assuming that a copy of that report is on your website if someone...
It is. The BPS website is www.bpsweb.org, and that white paper is on there, as well as detailed information about all of the specialties, the eligibility criteria, the content outlines. It's a great resource, and actually one of the things that we are required to maintain a very robust public communication for our accreditation, and the website makes the most sense to do it. So I do encourage individuals, if they have questions about BPS, visit the website, bpsweb.org, and there's quite a bit of information there. Hopefully you'll be able to find answers to questions that you might have.
Before I move on to your career, are there other comments that you wish to make about BPS?
Well, I want to reiterate, one of the things that's really been very rewarding to our board in this work is the ability to work across the profession. And you know, to partner with other organizations, to gather input within pharmacy, it's really great to be able to see that the entire profession can coalesce around an activity, around a goal, and that's been great. And I think that's important for folks to realize. Actually, sometimes the working relationship is so close that there is confusion among who BPS is and which organization is doing accrediting versus continuing education, but that's all right because it meets the goal. And our goal in board certification always was and always will be to improve patient care, because people say, well, why do I need to get board certified and what's the rationale behind this? And it's really all geared at a method to recognize expertise, skill, and experience that in the end advances patient care. Otherwise, there is no really valid reason to pursue board certification if it's not to improve patient health outcomes.
Let's drop back now and trace your career evolution. What attracted you to pharmacy as a career choice?
Well, like many of us, it kind of took a sort of a serendipitous path. I'd always been interested in science and healthcare, and originally was thinking about going to medical school, and got some high school guidance counselor advice that pharmacy, because you're going to have to do 4 years, in pharmacy's case five, before you'd apply to medical school, that this would be a good way to prepare if that's what you wanted to do. And so I had applied and was accepted to Philadelphia College of Pharmacy, and that was sort of my thought process day one, freshman year. But was really, once I was there and immersed in the curriculum and began to really truly appreciate what pharmacy was about, because I didn't come from a family of pharmacists, I really didn't have a lot of experience in pharmacy, I quickly realized there was so much potential there. And really abandon thoughts of medical education or training, because I realized what we could do in profession. The most critical juncture and the awakening for me was probably in my second or third year while I was there. I was attending an evening meeting of the Delaware Valley Society of Hospital Pharmacists, and the speaker that night was the late Tony Sorrentino from Thomas Jefferson University, and I was affected deeply that night by his talk, and it changed my whole perspective on my career. Tony was a home infusion pharmacist at Jefferson, as I'm sure you know, and he was on the patient care team, which, going back into the 80s was a pretty cool concept. It's funny now today we talk about that, but Tony was doing that back in the 80s, and many home health care pharmacists actually were. Probably didn't get the credit that they deserved. And he had a patient, it was a woman who had severe diabetes, it was uncontrolled. And she had developed a foot infection and ulcers, and the doctors made the decision that they needed to amputate at that point. And medically, that was probably the right decision to make, but Tony weighed in, because Tony actually got to know the patient. And what he shared with us that night was that patient had a husband who was disabled from an accident at work and had a son who was mentally handicapped, and she was the primary caregiver. And Tony said, if we do this procedure and we take this woman's foot or we take this woman's leg, he said, this is going to devastate this family. And so he prevailed upon the physicians to try a more aggressive course of antibiotic therapy, resolved the patient's infection. She was able to continue to be the primary caregiver in her family. And what was the awakening for me that night was that we had a role holistically in patient care. And it went well beyond the right medication to the right patient at the right time. And this is before Hepler and Strand talked about pharmaceutical care, and we started talking about that phrase and our responsibility to patients. And it was that just really affected me and helped me realize at that point that we could do so much more. And I guess subliminally, that's sort of when I dedicated my career to helping advance the patient care role of pharmacists. I had no idea where it would lead me at the time, but I had the good fortune of telling that to Tony before he passed, that I'm really grateful for that experience and for his willingness to step up out of the box, challenge other healthcare providers, because it was the right thing to do for the patient. So that was kind of how I started off thinking one thing in medical school and ended up with a very rewarding and satisfying career in pharmacy.
So how did you decide to complete the ASHP executive residency, and what did that do for you?
Well, it kind of builds off of that night. So, I realized that I wanted to help try to shape the direction of the profession. And so I got involved with the student APHA at the time, and was fortunate enough, working my way through the local chapter, actually serve as a national officer in student APHA. And then that's when I realized that pharmacists actually worked in associations. I guess I should have assumed that, but that hadn't really clicked with me. And, you know, I began to think that this might be a worthwhile way to help advance the profession. And it was very diverse and it was pretty exciting. And so I found out about, through John Koster, who was a year ahead of me both in student APHA and ultimately the executive residency, that there was such a program, and applied and was fortunate enough to be selected for that program. And then, as many residents will tell you, whether they're hospital residencies or the ASHP residency, the knowledge and the skill and the mentoring that occurs during that time is just absolutely amazing. I mean, my preceptor, Mary Jo Riley, shared all kinds of information with me, spent time, was patient, taught me so many things, and to be able to interact with individuals like Joe Otis, who were there at the time, and Warren McConnell, and everyone on that staff really took an interest and helped me grow personally and professionally. And so I'm really forever indebted for that experience. People ask me, you know, well, what did it teach you? You know, and it's funny, it's not like you rattle off a list of these things, but what I think it really taught me, and what a lot of residencies I think teach people, is it teaches you a thought process that will carry you throughout your entire career if you really apply it. And, you know, as a young person, I mean, it taught you how to be a professional and mature and communicate, but it really taught you a thought process. One of the things it also taught me, you know, as a humbling lesson too, was know what you don't know. And I still rely on that today. And I see so many people at all levels of business get in trouble when they think they know something when they really don't, or they're afraid to say they don't know something. And so that was an important lesson that I learned in that process.
And your next job was as the paid staff exec for the Pennsylvania Society. Talk about what that entailed.
Oh, that was a great experience. You know, I went from the ASHP executive residency to the Pennsylvania Society. And I was a pretty young guy at that time. And so I guess I figured either this was going to work or I was going to have a very short-lived career in association management. And fortunately, it worked out pretty well. Great support staff there from the very strong health system pharmacist in Pennsylvania, Patty Keenly, Jerry Meyer, who's currently ASHP president, Steve Schaefer, another past president. Herb Flack at the time, who I was replacing, who was retiring. And that was really about rolling up your sleeves. It was a small staff and helping, trying to move a profession forward and just help those pharmacists throughout the state do their jobs as best they can on a day-to-day basis. Probably the biggest issue we were dealing with during that time frame there is there was no hospital pharmacist represented on the State Board of Pharmacy. And that probably became a 4 or 5 year process to be able to try to have hospital pharmacy practice recognized at the state board level. I mean, it's kind of amazing as I sit there and say that today that was an issue, but that really was an issue at the time. And so we ultimately were successful in doing that. The other thing now today that I think back on that we dealt with some initial drug shortages, which is funny how history repeats itself. And now obviously they're much more widespread, but there were a few drug shortages that came up. And so we did what we had to do and helped identify other sources of product to make sure that our members could get what they need and to be there to be a resource to help folks network. That was really what a lot of that was about at the state level, creating a community for people to work together. And of course, this was before social media and a lot widespread use of the internet or any of those things. So a lot of that was face-to-face phone calls, written communication, and it was important to hold together a group of practitioners in the state. And at the time too, you know, we needed to be there. We dealt with some horrific medication errors while we were there. I still have the clipping from the Philadelphia Daily News that says 3 babies dead, hospital pharmacy to blame, and a horrific accident, and to be able to help educate the public, because initially folks thought, well, how could pharmacists be so incompetent? And it was an opportunity to educate folks, because it wasn't as much about incompetence, because they had a pharmacy IV admixture program. What people didn't realize is there were many hospitals that didn't even have pharmacists mixing IVs. But it started to bring to light the whole issue of medication errors and safety and confusion between products. And we had the good fortune of having, you know, the foremost expert there in Pennsylvania, and Mike Cohen in the Institute for Safe Medication Practices. And, you know, I think that really started a discussion and one more widely discussed, because back in those days, people didn't want to talk about medication errors. You know, we just need to keep that quiet. And so that was really a couple of the things during that time that were pivotal, that were really exciting to be involved in.
You left after about a decade. What were your decision points about leaving?
Well, the decision to leave the Pennsylvania Society of Health System Pharmacists was driven a little bit by the opportunity that the APHA Foundation presented. Within the foundation, we had an opportunity to do practice-based research to demonstrate firsthand what pharmacists could do to improve patient care. And that was something that was always important to me, and something that was really a unique opportunity and different than what we had done, than what you were really responsible for doing in a state society. A state society, you were dealing with the legal issues and policy issues and things like that. And so this was an opportunity for me to continue to pursue improving patient care through pharmacists, but you know, the opportunity to actually demonstrate it was very exciting. So that was probably the biggest driver. It was a hard decision to make. Tremendous relationships there within Pennsylvania, and but we think that they, you know, at the time it was the right decision, and it was. You know, I think in these kinds of positions, having folks pick up where you left off and move it to the next level is oftentimes healthy for organizations.
So contrast a foundation with APHA, because they are separate.
Yeah, so you know, in the foundation, you have to exist for philanthropic purposes. So you have to do, you know, education, research, charity work. You're not involved in government affairs, lobbying, policy development, those kinds of things. You could do education, but you don't necessarily always have to. I don't know that many foundations do, unless you're doing public education. So there's kind of a different focus. In a foundation, you're absolutely focused at the public as a nonprofit charitable organization. Within the association, your primary responsibility is to your members, even though most national associations sort of have certainly sensitivity to the public and that, but the scope of work is different. So the APHA Foundation was really set up to be the research arm for APHA. So we had a clear direction and mission there.
So far in your career, what's brought you the most satisfaction?
You know, I think that, you know, each position that I've held has certainly had a lot of high points. I think generally the fact that if in some way I've helped contribute to expanding the role of the pharmacist and helping improve patients, then it's all been worth it. And I've been fortunate to have an opportunity, hopefully, to contribute in some small way. You know, John Gans in the Whitney lecture summed it up best, you know, in asking the profession to step up the responsibilities, because I think he simply said, you know, one day we're all going to be patients. And, you know, to help craft or contribute in some small way to a healthcare system that I might be able to benefit from, my family, you, and anyone else, is sort of where I get professional satisfaction. I often joke with students and others that I practice vicariously because I'm not practicing on a day-to-day basis. But if I can provide the support system, the structure to those practitioners to go out and do the great work that they do, then I feel good about that.
What's the most significant learning you've had from a less than desirable outcome?
I think I said earlier, you know, sort of know what you don't know, which is tricky, to know just enough to realize you got to get some more information. And, you know, and I think is the other thing, some of which have worked out, some of which haven't, is not being afraid to try or to fail. You know, to me, because I've had some things that have been successful, I had some things that haven't worked out. In the foundation, we tried to launch and scale some pharmacist patient care services in a more formalized way as a business opportunity, and it didn't really materialize. But, you know, John Gans had an interesting take on that, because he said, you know, once you've expanded someone's mind, they can never go back again. So even though we didn't achieve our initial goal there of formalizing these services, hopefully we've expanded folks' minds and others will come in and they'll fill that gap and we'll look back over a period of time. So yeah, we did make a contribution here. Maybe not as we originally intended, but we did make a contribution.
What's the best mentoring advice that you've received, and what kind of advice do you give young folks?
You know, one of the things that Joe Otis told me that I remember, and was one of the final things he said before I actually left the day I completed the residency, and it was about not getting so caught up in brush fires that you realize the forest could be burning down around you. So it was really to make sure you always maintain a big picture perspective. I mean, obviously you've got to focus on some immediate things, But, and I've really come to appreciate this, I remembered it as a resident. I didn't really get to experience it until much later, that you can be so caught up sometimes in smaller things that you can lose sight of the big picture and probably lose the opportunity to really contribute and be effective at a much larger level because you sort of box yourself into dealing with smaller things. You know, the book, Don't Sweat the Small Stuff. I mean, it was really along that line to make sure, particularly if you're in a leadership position, to keep a big picture vision. So that I've always held that near and dear as I've gone through and trying to step back and say, hey, am I sweating the small stuff here, or am I really continuing to think about big picture? It's pretty germane to where we're at in BPS right now, because we really do have to think big picture, not just this year, next year, 5 years, but 10, 15, 20 years. Are we doing things now that will hold up and scale and stand the test of time? So that was probably the best advice that I got. But there's a whole long list of really good advice that I got. But that's probably one that sticks out. You know, in terms of students, you know, it was one of the lessons that I learned and is one of my soapbox issues. I think today students are so talented and they work so hard and they're so driven, you know, particularly in the classroom to get good grades, that I actually find that sometimes young people today are afraid to fail. And you know, I try to tell them, it's one thing to be afraid to fail, but that can become like a cancer and it can metastasize into the fear to try. And when you're afraid to try, you failed. You absolutely will fail every single time. And so that's my concern for young people. And that's general, that's not every single one, but I sense that now a little bit more with folks coming up in freshman, conservative, don't want to fail, and that's okay to be afraid to fail, but it oftentimes goes into a fear to try. And if that happens in a widespread way, we're in trouble as a profession. And so there's a lot at stake. So I want to try to make sure that to the extent that I can, that I try to snuff out that mentality among students and people entering the profession, not to be afraid to try and not to be afraid to fail.
Bill, these comments have been fantastic. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you, sir. It's been an honor.